I suppose that this paragraph I'm about to read is a statement of my own professional belief about what a biography should do. The subject of a biography should be the person's search for identity. Answering the question, who am I, is the great work of life, and all of a person's efforts are, in some way, responses to that unvoiced question.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with biographer Charles Shields about his book, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel.
The stoner will, like water dripping on a stone, will wear down any opposition to it and will become a classic of the 20th century.
Biographer Charles Shields, Stoner and the Writing Life. The Perfect Novel? You decide. Coming up on Arts and Letters.
Obituaries about John Williams seem more interested in how the National Book Award was split for the first time in its history in the year he received it for Augustus, 1973, and the unusual display of public disagreement among the judges than in what his works had contributed to American literature.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with biographer Charles Shields about the life and writing of novelist John Williams.
None of his three major works, Butcher's Crossing, Stoner, or Augustus, held a mirror up to present-day society the way The Struggles of Saul Bellow's Herzog did, or James Baldwin's short story collection about race, Going to Meet the Man, both of which were being talked about in 1965, the year Stoner appeared.
And we'll look at one novel in particular, Stoner, about a professor whose unremarkable life casts a stone into the water that ripples on.
William Stoner entered the University of Missouri as a freshman in the year 1910 at the age of 19. 8 years later, during the height of World War I, he received his Doctor of Philosophy degree and accepted an instructorship at the same university, where he taught until his death in 1956. He did not rise above the rank of assistant professor, and few students remembered him with any sharpness after they had taken his courses. When he died, his colleagues made a memorial contribution of a medieval manuscript to the university library. This manuscript may still be found in the Rare Books Collection, bearing the inscription, "Presented to the Library of the University of Missouri, in memory of William Stoner, Department of English, by his colleagues."
Charles J. Shields, biographer. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's an absolute thrill for us to have you here on Arts and Letters. Few people know who John Williams was.
Right.
Few people know about his novels. You had done Kurt Vonnegut before, then Harper Lee.
Right.
Why did you pick such a kind of obscure author?
Well, I like to be the first biographer on the scene. I wrote the first biography of Harper Lee, the first biography of Kurt Vonnegut. And so I read Stoner, and when I closed it, I thought to myself, who is this man? It's such a beautiful book. And then when I realized that he was relatively unknown and no one had written a biography of him, I thought this is an opportunity to sort of pay homage to a real artist.
Let's hear from John Williams in his own words.
Writers love to say how much they suffer when they write a novel. It isn't really true. It's a lot of work and it's hard work, but there's a great joy in doing it too, even while you're doing it. I write very slowly, and what you enjoy, I think, is it's not mystical. You enjoy learning things.
So let's just talk about the title of your biography, which comes from a newspaper quote.
Morris Dickstein, he's a cultural critic and a literary critic, and he called it The Perfect Novel in a review. And my wife actually suggested that I call the biography by that as well, because it would, I think, make people curious to open it up and say, oh yeah, I'll be the judge of who wrote The Perfect Novel. Who is this guy? My agent warned me that being as relatively unknown as John was, that there wouldn't be a lot of takers for a biography. But I did this out of love for the novel and to honor John as a novelist.
In particular, the Stoner novel, because he had written a novel called Butcher's Crossing before that, and then Augustus after that.
Yes, and he received the National Book Award for Augustus. He split it with another novelist. That was the first time the fiction award had ever been split.
And how they crowd themselves together, these Romans. Beyond the walls of the city lies some of the most beautiful countryside that you can imagine. Yet the people huddle together here like fish trapped in a net and struggle through narrow, winding little streets that run senselessly mile after mile through the city. During the daylight hours, these streets, all of them, are literally choked with people, and the noise and stench are incredible.
Let's just talk about John Williams, his early life growing up in Wichita Falls, Texas. So tell us about his early life.
Well, John came from a hard scrabble background. His grandparents were kind of Sooners in the sense that they moved around the Great Plains trying different farms, vegetable farming, came to Clarksville, Texas, thinking there was more opportunity there. And it was a good little town in those days. Clarksville's by the Red River. And there his mother, Amelia, met a man named John Jewell. They married. John was born, and his father was murdered by a hitchhiker. Although in the book I raised the possibility that his father just ran off.
And also that they never really knew exactly what happened. Right?
I couldn't find any evidence anywhere of a murder, but everybody connected with the family is convinced that the man was murdered. Mm-hmm. So I gave both versions. But how it affected John Williams is this way. He did not find out until he was 9 years old that his biological father was John Jewell and his father, current father, John Williams, was his stepfather. John Williams' discovery at age 9 that he was someone else, not his father's son, not a Williams, and not related to his little sister, George Ray, in the way that he'd been led to believe, upended his world. The narrative of who he was, the one he had been telling himself all along, was actually a story about another boy who was like him, but not him. He had the skin of John Williams on him, and the adults in his family, his mother, stepfather, and grandparents, had agreed to present him that way to everyone, including himself. It would be hard to imagine a more convincing early lesson for a future writer about the power of words to suspend disbelief.
Let's hear again from John Williams.
I think, in a sense, this is what writing is all about, to see the world in a way that has not been seen before. I think that's finally the reason one keeps on writing, hoping that one might see the world a little bit better and be able to put it down on paper.
So it led John on a journey to find out his true identity. And he made that identity as a writer. He decided he wanted to be a writer, and he invented himself in that regard.
I have a hunch that we all begin writing for the wrong reasons. I hope that we don't continue writing for the wrong reasons, but I think we all begin out of vanity, out of some kind of ego, out of some kind of need to express ourselves, things of that sort. I think probably later, if we keep on doing it, we're involved in something a little more serious than that.
There's a kind of mirroring in here, the idea of who you are and who you're perceived to be.
Yes.
And who you kind of want to be.
Exactly.
And so John's invited by an aunt to bring a friend to see a film, A Tale of Two Cities, starring Ronald Colman.
One afternoon when he was 13, in the spring of 1936, he saw such a character, a persona really, at the movies in Wichita Falls. The experience enchanted him.
Which one is Evremond? That's him there. But he calls himself Donnie, Charles Donnie. And I tell you, the Marquis is going to make it well worthwhile for the both of us.
Yes, he goes to the movies, see Tale of Two Cities. And if you remember the story, there's two men who look very much alike. And he stands in for an accused man on the guillotine. But the ending of the book, it is a far, far better thing that I do than anything I've ever done before.
It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done. It's a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known.
And so this wastrel of a person becomes noble in the last 10 pages of the book. And to John...
Because he sacrifices himself for the other guy.
Yes, and it hit John like a thunderbolt that it's never too late. You make who you want to be, and it can be an internal decision. You don't have to be a victim of circumstance. You can decide to be someone else. So John Jewell / Williams decided that he was going to take his destiny into his own hands. In the meantime, the question, who am I, was reopened just when he was entering adolescence, a period when young people try out various faces on the world to see how they're received. Because of what he'd found out, he was more susceptible than most to choosing a radically new appearance, one that would compensate for how he'd been fooled, one that would give others the impression of competence and self-possession. Ideally, too, it would be in sync with his love of books and stories, and his fascination with the heroism of airmen and frontiersmen. A galvanizing incident in his life was in the eighth grade, he wrote a paper on Tale of Two Cities. And the teacher read it aloud and said to the class, "This is the work of a college student." And he said, "It was the first compliment of that kind I'd ever received in my life. Apparently, I could do something really well." And so by the time he's a senior in high school, he is writing and producing radio plays, which were enormously popular in the late 30s, at the local radio station in Wichita Falls.
And he must have had a beautiful voice.
He did, yes. He sounds like he's talking into an oil drum. It's so deep and resonant.
We think of history as being impersonal, scientific, and whatever. It ain't true. I had a friend once who used to write nonfiction, and he stopped writing nonfiction and started writing novels because he said, "I stopped writing nonfiction because it's too easy to lie that way, and it's difficult to lie when you write a novel."
It says, in the high school yearbook, The Coyote, he listed two things that he liked. Me, which I think is hilarious, and the color black.
Yeah, as befits a Byronic character, he liked the color black.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to biographer Charles Shields. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our discussion with biographer Charles Shields about his book, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel, about the life of novelist John Williams. Born in Wichita Falls on a farm with an avid imagination, Williams reinvents himself.
So he's growing up in Wichita Falls during the Depression, you know, when men are standing on street corners with their hands in their pockets in threadbare suits, and John comes by wearing a scarf knotted at his neck, with what he thinks is an English-looking jacket. And he is proclaiming the fact that he is his own invention.
Tell us a little bit about his sister, George Ray.
Well, she has a strange name, George Ray, because her father wanted a boy. And so George Ray is a compromise name. But she was devoted to John, and they were very similar in the sense that they were both a little theatrical.
She seems a little more so.
Yes, a little more so.
I mean, because she wants to be an actress.
She wants to be an actress,
right.
Exactly. So they were both petite people, and John's fourth wife, Nancy, said that they were as alike as two peas in a pod when they were together. There was a real communion between them.
This is 1942. The reason he decides to enlist in the Army Air Corps, even though he has not a bad job on the radio, but he realizes that I better do something that I can do, or if I don't, I'm probably going to be on the front lines.
Right, yeah. He's a young man, newly married. War has broken out. He's avoided or hasn't been drafted for 8-9 months, but he knows it's coming. It's one of those decision moments.
You know, and he was married to Aileen.
Yes.
And it was short-lived in the sense that he had only been married 5 months when he decides to enlist. And he sees her there together in that beautiful scene one time.
Yes.
And then pretty much he writes him a Dear John letter.
Exactly. You know, it's not widely known, but I think almost a third of World War II marriages failed. Mm-hmm. It's young people caught up in a moment that will never come again, and Right. Some of them made the wrong decision. And many of John's friends never knew that he was married to that woman. He didn't even mention that marriage
to his wife. Really?
Yeah. And when someone, you know, found out about it and asked him, he said, well, that was my fault. The failure with Aileen was one in a series of attempts at respectability. He had dropped out of junior college and tried his hand at radio plays and stage direction. Next, he had started a career in broadcasting, which turned out to be a disappointing job of covering country fairs and selling advertising. To compensate, he bestowed on himself a non-existent degree from the University of New Mexico. About the time of her letter, Williams had a studio portrait taken in Calcutta. Like a movie star, he is looking up and off to his left, the light falling on his face, accentuating his large eyes and close-cropped mustache. Most men and women in uniform preferred a straight-ahead shot like a yearbook photo, but Williams went for effect. He's dressed in a sharply pressed airman's tunic, his right shoulder thrusting forward with the China-Burma-India campaign patch, a striped shield on whose blue field rests the Kuomintang Sun of China and the Star of India. There's a bid for transcendence about the way he looks up into the light. It isn't accidental. It's part performance, part personal narrative. He means to say that he's different, and he's artistic, a romantic. He's still Ronald Coleman in spirit, the gentleman swashbuckler. But the facts of William's young life so far did not shine favorably on him becoming successful.
Allied transport planes flew the 500-mile resupply route every day, sometimes twice, soaring over the highest mountain in the world, the 30,000-foot wall of the Himalayas, nicknamed the Hump by pilots. And you said how many missions he went on?
I think he probably went on about 80 missions. That's an educated guess, how long he was there. So after a 5-year stint overseas in Burma.
And that was a tough stint.
Yeah, he was flying the Hump as a radio man on cargo planes going into China.
With no heat.
With no heat.
And they're trying to get up over the mountain.
28,000-foot mountains.
Many of them didn't.
Right, yes, exactly right. In fact, when you landed on the other side and got out of the plane to walk into the mess hall for a cup of coffee, there was a sign over the door that said, "You made it again." During night thunderstorms, the propellers sometimes became wrapped in the blue orbs of St. Elmo's fire. Spidery filaments of electricity crackled around the windows of the cockpit like miniature lightning. Occasionally, when a pent-up charge arced with the plane's steel frame, an explosive blue fireball knocked out Williams' radio equipment and stopped communication with the ground. Winter storms brought another kind of terror. The C-47 was a workhorse, but when the wings were glazed with ice, it waddled drunkenly. At those times, Williams came forward and grabbed the retraction lever between the pilots, running the landing gear up and down to reduce the plane's tipsiness. The wheels partly down acted like a keel, but they also created an additional drag that might cause the plane to stall. A sudden drop in altitude sent loose objects slamming against the cabin roof. If the plane crashed in the jungle, tribes of headhunters, the tattooed Naga people, were down there to meet them.
Then we don't know if it's fictional or not.
The Japanese stayed near enough to the landing field that they could actually strike an incoming plane in the belly with a mortar. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in the plane that he was in, and he was thrown from the wreckage.
But there's all kinds of wild disparities about what really happened.
Yeah, it's difficult to tell. You know, it's sort of like what Truman Capote did when he was a child. He would tell a real whopper, and his aunt would say, "Oh, Truman, that's not true." And he would say, "If that's not how it happened, that's how it should have happened."
He's very affected by the war.
Yes. He said something about you get used to the killing. You become accustomed to it. And hearing that, yeah, so-and-so didn't come back.
You right.
know, they hit the mountain.
He's working on a novel
mm-hmm.
when he's there.
Nothing But the Night. And John would work on it as a young airman in
right.
Burma. But he confessed later that he had no idea what he was doing. He'd never taken a creative writing course. He was trying to write like he thought authors wrote. And he thought that to be literature, it should be heavily laden with deep meaning, which he force-fed that first novel of his.
In this dream where he was weightless and unalive, where he was a pervading mist of consciousness that seethed and trembled in a vast stretch of dark, there was at first no feeling, only a dim sort of appreciation, eyeless, brainless, and remote.
He had read some Freud, and he liked psychological novels. He was a great admirer of Moby Dick. And so consequently, he tried to make that slim first novel do a lot of work, and it shows.
Plays out in one Joycean day and night.
Yes.
You're right. And it, but it's very edible.
And together on the general summer day that was his childhood, awed and silent, they had listened to the whisper of the cool water. They had basked in the sunlight, his tousled hair upon her breast, his eager, small body in the crook of her moist arm. They had breathed together quietly, reverently, both aware of the earth's breathing. And turning sleepily, warmly on the earth, his lost voice asking, "Mother, where does the water run?" And the answering miracle, "To the sea, down to the sea."
So after he gets out of the war, what does he decide to do?
First, he goes to Key West to take up where he left off, and that seems to be the logical thing for him to do. And then it's away from Key West, and he enrolls in graduate school at the University of Denver because Alan Swallow, who's a professor at the University of Denver, has a small press operation called Swallow Press, and John sends him Nothing But the Night, the manuscript for it. And Alan Swallow, to his eternal credit, writes a very long, encouraging letter to a young man who's a wannabe writer and tells him, "You've got something here, but it's not publishable as is." And Alan Swallow guides him into a life of writing and teaching.
Let's hear again from John Williams.
The young people that you talk to about writing, I try to keep away from that. All I can do with them when I used to teach writing is to try to make them write as well as they possibly can. And the rest of what they do is completely up to them. I neither discourage nor encourage their trying to write.
At one point, John is even working in Alan Swallow's garage, packing and binding the books for Swallow Press, which exposes him to freshly written manuscripts by scholars.
Intellectuals.
And he becomes accustomed to thinking like a man of letters as opposed to just being a book lover.
There's this whole intellectual world that he gets very caught up in, which has a particular mantra. So Ivor Winters has a manifesto about literature and
yes.
life that discounts romanticism
mm-hmm.
and imagines reason is all,
yes.
particularly in poetry.
Ivor Winters, in his day, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, was one of the preeminent American literary critics. He was read and admired throughout the United States. He could be bombastic, he could be imperious, but he loved literature, and he came to the belief that the best example of English literature was that which was based on the classical model of restraint.
Let's listen to poet Ivor Winters read from his poem,
Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Reptilian green, the wrinkled throat, green as a bough of yew, the beard. He bent his head, and so I smote. Then for a thought my vision cleared. The head dropped clean, he rose and walked. He fixed his fingers in the hair. The head was unabashed and talked. I understood what I must dare.
And Winters is this larger-than-life figure who puts together anthologies of poets that he thinks have been dismissed.
Yes, the Winters canon. Ivor Winters creates his own canon of approved poets, elevates some who have been forgotten for three centuries, and puts them in the pantheon of great poets. John was so mightily impressed by this that when there came an opportunity for John to put together an anthology for classroom use of Elizabethan poets, he cribbed quite a bit from Winters.
And they're good friends.
Yes.
And Winters is absolutely furious to the point where he's considering suing. And
oh, he writes to the publisher and he says, I'll ruin
his... this book can't come out. And
exactly.
And they were never friends after that either, were they?
No, and you know, and John wanted so badly to be part of the Winters Circle, as it was called,
right,
the acolytes of Ivor Winters. And instead, what happens? He becomes Winters' enemy, quite frankly. If he had just asked Winters to introduce the book or paid him the courtesy of admitting that he owes all this to Winters.
Sure.
But Winters was volcanic in his anger.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to biographer Charles Shields. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our discussion with biographer Charles Shields about his book, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel, about the life of novelist John Williams. Novelist John Williams continually reinvents himself as a radio broadcaster, an Army Air Corps man, an academic, and a novelist.
Then a more positive awareness began to grow inside him, a kind of gratitude for the insensible thing he was in dream. Wordlessly and thoughtlessly, he cherished it so that he had any choice, he would have elected to remain forever in that sightless womb of nothingness.
Swallow Press brought out John's first novel, Nothing But the Night. But that book is barely worth talking about. Even John pushed it to one side. He didn't like to discuss it. His first genuine effort where he felt in control of the material was Butcher's Crossing, which is a revisionist Western about a buffalo hunt that goes all wrong. A young man, Andrews, goes out west expecting some kind of spiritual experience that Emerson promised him with nature. And what he finds out is that it's unforgiving, it's relentlessly boring being out there on the plains. When they're on the buffalo hunt in Butcher's Crossing, the young man, the protagonist, is stunned by the nakedness of the Great Plains.
The Great Plain swayed beneath them as they went steadily westward. The rich buffalo grass, upon which their animals fattened even during the arduous journey, changed its color throughout the day. In the morning, in the pinkish rays of the early sun, it was nearly gray. Later, in the yellow light of the mid-morning sun, it was a brilliant green. At noon, it took on a bluish cast. In the afternoon, in the intensity of the sun, at a distance, the blades lost their individual character, and through the green showed a distinct cast of yellow, so that when a light breeze whipped across, a living color seemed to run through the grass, to disappear and reappear moment to moment.
It's a good novel, though.
It's a fine novel, and John pinned so many of his hopes on it.
Took him a long time.
Yeah, it took him a long time to write it, and what happened was cheap drugstore westerns were very popular and sold by the tens of thousands. And some genius at its publisher decided that they would make this look like a regular Western and slapped a cover on it involving a Conestoga wagon and some people looking at the horizon, when none of those characteristics were between the covers of that book. It was about something entirely different, and it was a different genre. It wasn't the typical gunslinging.
As you said, it was a precursor to much of the kind of existential West books.
It was like All the Pretty Horses in terms of its fierceness. And so they brought it out, and it gets a devastatingly contemptuous review in the New York Times by a respected Western novelist. Respected in the sense that he could write these dime store type novels, and he knew whereof he spoke. And he said, "This is the most god-awful boring book I've ever read set in the West. It's like a snail trying to make its way through molasses." And John is, he says, in a letter to his agent, I'm almost physically sick, you know, and when I get back to the office on Monday, don't think that my colleagues won't be laughing behind their hands at the English professor who tried to write a Western novel and couldn't do it.
Late in March and early in April, the weather settled. And day by day, with agonizing slowness, Andrews watched the snow melt in the valley. It melted first where it had drifted most thinly, so that the once level valley became a patchwork of bleached grass and humped banks of dirtying snow. The days became weeks.
Butcher's Crossing just kind of dies on the vine.
Yes.
Goes out of print, right?
Almost immediately.
And what a blow.
Yes.
He put so much into it, this existential Western.
Yeah.
But he's resilient, if nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides he's working on another novel.
Back to the desk.
He was born in 1891 on a small farm in central Missouri near the village of Boonville, some 40 miles from Columbia, the home of the university. Though his parents were young at the time of his birth, his father 25, his mother barely 20, Stoner thought of them, even when he was a boy, as old.
Stoner is a farm boy who is sent to college by his folks, and his intention is to major in agriculture so that he can come back with newfangled ways of making the farm more productive. It's fitting that Stoner, the son of a farmer, should come to the brink of his vegetable world and view the columns as a kind of outpost of the ancient tradition of thought and inquiry. Enrolled to study agriculture, Stoner grows lonely in this strange world of metaphysics, discussion, and analysis.
He did his work at the university as he did his work on the farm, thoroughly, conscientiously, with neither pleasure nor distress. At the end of his first year, his grade average was slightly below a B. He was pleased that it was no lower and not concerned that it was no higher.
And he doesn't particularly want to, but he's required to take an introductory course in English literature, during which he reads a sonnet by Shakespeare.
"This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long."
And is smitten, literally. I mean, he can't speak when called upon. And when he looks around, the world is somehow changed. A shaft of light coming in through the window seems very still to him. You know how people say they see things in slow motion when something very, very critical is about to happen? He sees a mote of dust floating in that shaft of light as he's trying to say how he feels about this sonnet.
Sloane's eyes came back to William Stoner, and he said dryly, "Mr. Shakespeare speaks to you across 300 years, Mr. Stoner. Do you hear him?" William Stoner realized that for several moments he had been holding his breath. He expelled it gently, minutely aware of his clothing moving upon his body as his breath went out of his lungs. He looked away from Sloane about the room. Light slanted from the windows and settled upon the faces of his fellow students, so that the illumination seemed to come from within them and go out against the dimness.
And when he goes to see that professor later in his office and is talking about that experience, the professor says, "Don't you understand, Mr. Stoner, you're going to be a teacher."
Suddenly, Sloane seemed very distant, and the walls of the office receded. Stoner felt himself suspended in the wide air, and he heard his voice ask, "Are you sure?" "I'm sure," Sloane said softly. "How can you tell? How can you be sure?" "It's love, Mr. Stoner," Sloane said cheerfully. "You are in love. It's as simple as that."
The professor says, "Don't you know?
Yes.
You're going to become a teacher."
Yes.
Of English.
John Williams was very interested in hinge moments like that in a person's life, but he did not attribute any kind of agency to the world in turning you around or making you realize something. You happened to be fortunate enough to cast into the right part of the river where there was a trout, and you caught something.
And there is, in Stoner and Butcher's Crossing and Augustus, a sense of distancing, a sense of isolation, a sense of the man journeying inwardly.
Yes, very much so. John's characters live a life of the mind, and sometimes it's very lonely in there, and they can't get out of thought.
Once, late, after his evening class, he returned to his office and sat at his desk, trying to read. It was winter, and the snow had fallen during the day, so that the out-of-doors was covered with a white softness. The office was overheated. He opened a window beside the desk so that the cool air might come into the close room. He breathed deeply, and let his eyes wander over the white floor of the campus. On an impulse, he switched out the light on his desk and sat in the hot darkness of his office. The cold air filled his lungs, and he leaned toward the open window. He heard the silence of the winter night, and it seemed to him that he somehow felt the sounds that were absorbed by the delicate and intricately cellular being of the snow. Nothing moved upon the whiteness. It was a dead scene, which seemed to pull at him, to suck at his consciousness just as it pulled the sound from the air and buried it within a cold white softness.
Aside from the parallels between Stoner, who is an English professor,
yes,
and then Williams, who was an English professor,
right,
and you were also a teacher.
Yes.
And what I did find so interesting in this was just the moments of teaching, because I think in a lot of ways you might suggest that Stoner is really about a man who is unremarkable at the beginning.
Yes.
He becomes remarkable in the sense that he does get a PhD,
and, right,
but really dedicates his life at a certain point to teaching.
Always, from the time he had fumbled through his first classes of freshman English, he had been aware of the gulf that lay between what he felt for his subject and what he delivered in the classroom. He had hoped that time and experience would repair the gulf, but they had not done so. Those things that he held most deeply were most profoundly betrayed when he spoke of them in his classes. What was most alive withered in his words, and what moved him most became cold in its utterance. And the consciousness of his inadequacy distressed him so greatly that the sense of it grew habitual, as much a part of him as the stoop of his shoulders.
There's a point in the novel when Stoner can't put up with one thing more. There's a point at which he will not go beyond, and that is when he discovers that a graduate student has been coached in his orals by his advisor. And Stoner has put up with a lot of indignity in his life. But if he doesn't resist this as a scholar, what does he stand for?
"Come off it, Holly," Stoner said tiredly. "The man's incompetent. There can be no question of that. The questions I asked him were those that should have been asked a fair undergraduate, and he was unable to answer a single one of them satisfactorily. And he's both lazy and dishonest."
And it breaks his career at the university because the man who was coaching the grad student also happens to be the department chairman.
And with the unenviable name of Lomax.
Lomax,
right,
yes.
Right, kind of the villain.
Yes, Lomax. And he goes out of his way to break John.
Someone whispered, "It's Lomax." And the sound was sharp and audible through the room. He had come through the door, closed it, and had advanced a few steps beyond the threshold, where he now stood.
And after a good career as a teacher, about 20 years length, he's busted down to freshman rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a classicist.
I sense, at least in Stoner, and the Stoner is so autobiographical in certain ways, mm-hmm. this idea of, I know what I should do, mm-hmm. but I don't know how. You know, but he can write it.
He can write it, right. But he can't say it or stand the emotional pressure involved in being intimate with another person.
What is his issue with women? And by that I mean he has trouble being close to them.
John has trouble being intimate with women. He likes women physically. He wants to be around women. He wants to be understood, but he can't close the emotional gap, which is the same problem that his characters have.
But I love you just the same. I love you just the same. I love you just the same. I love you just the same.
Her name was Catherine Driscoll, and she was in her late 20s. Stoner had never really noticed her until she talked to him after class about the report and asked him if he would be willing to read her dissertation when she got it finished. He told her that he welcomed the report and that he would be glad to read her dissertation.
That's so true. This existential dilemma between...
Right. Thought and action. See, John, in his mind, had a binary that separated emotion and reason. And he couldn't seem to appreciate that there are many places to be in between. They're not appositional, emotion and reason. But John chose reason. Even when he's trying to say to his graduate student lover, whom he falls in love with, even when he's trying to express that he loves her, he can't seem to bridge that gap, and she finally says, "You darling, come here.
You love me just the same. Then I love you just the same.
When I finished the novel Stoner, I had immense respect for his fidelity to the nature of life, the way things actually are. There's no juggling going on in here. There's no trickery. This is a faithful reporting of the life of an unremarkable man. But his triumph at the end is that Stoner realizes who he is and what he has been in life.
During the decade when many men's faces found a permanent hardness and bleakness, as if they looked upon an abyss, William Stoner, to whom that expression was as familiar as the air he walked in, saw signs of a general despair he had known since he was a boy. He saw good men go down into a slow decline of hopelessness, broken as their vision of a decent life was broken. He saw them walking aimlessly upon the streets, their eyes empty like shards of broken glass. He saw them walk up to back doors with the bitter pride of men who go to their executions and beg for the bread that would allow them to beg again. And he saw men who had once walked erect in their own identities look at him with envy and hatred for the poor security he enjoyed as a tenured employee of an institution that somehow could not fail. He did not give voice to this awareness. But the knowledge of common misery touched him and changed him in ways that were hidden deep from the public view, and the quiet sadness for the common plight was never far beneath any moment of his living.
Stoner does endure too much, he accepts too much, and he doesn't fight enough, Williams wrote to a friend. But if these are vices, they are vices that are merely the obverse of certain virtues, virtues that allow him to endure in one world, his profession, at the expense of his happiness in another, his marriage.
How is Stoner received? Once again.
Once again, he sold 2,500 books and went out of print. But John was convinced that he had gained the respect of people who admired or could appreciate literature, that he had done what he set out to do.
And this is, I think, really the truth of this book. Everybody gives it to you.
Right.
At one point in time.
Right.
So I've had three people give me this book. and one was an older professor who was a mentor.
Right.
And he said, Brad, you have to read this.
Yes.
And people kind of put it off. But then when they come to it, it seems to be, it profoundly changes them.
Yes.
How did this book find its way to Europe and then explode, rejuvenate, and then again, not so much in America, but really just found its way to kind of a European acclaim?
Right. A French novelist, a woman, read Stoner and thought this is a marvelous book, and she did a translation. Right. She read it in English, obviously. It hadn't been translated into French.
Right.
She read it in English, and she translated it into French, and the book took off. In fact, Europeans call it Stoner Mania because the book was translated into a number of European languages and spoke to them in a way that it hasn't spoken yet to Americans. And I asked several Europeans, why has the book gained such a purchase in Europe when it hasn't in the United States? And the answer I get consistently is that we Europeans have seen destruction, have seen war. We know that life is fragile, and this is something very tenuous and gossamer that John Williams is writing about in Stoner. It's the true nature of life, and we appreciate that. So this quiet interior book speaks to us. You Americans are eternally optimistic. You think that there's something just over the horizon, and we Europeans have given up on that. And when he won the National Book Award for Augustus, many people said he should have gotten it for Stoner.
Sure.
And so we're going to give it to him for Augustus.
Would you tell us about his Arkansas years?
Well, after John became a senior professor at the University of Denver and won the National Book Award, he kept pushing and pushing for more time to write, longer sabbaticals, longer vacations, and they finally struck a deal where he could teach one quarter at Denver and still be on the payroll, so to speak. And so they kept an apartment in Denver, and he went back to Key West, I think trying to recreate those first heady years when he came out of the Army Air Corps. It was all ahead of him. And so now he was a free man, and they go to Key West, and time and tide has passed them by. He's not in his 20s. He's a man in his 60s
and
now.
He has terrible problems breathing.
Has terrible
he's
problems.
He's been smoking like a crazy man.
Exactly. As Nancy said, the only time that John wasn't smoking was when he was asleep.
Wow.
So they go to Key West. He has trouble breathing. And it's a lifestyle for younger people. They don't belong there. Mm-hmm. But there are people in the area like John Chardy and Tennessee Williams. But that's not enough to make a literary community for John. And so he gets an invitation to come to Fayetteville. And it seems to be a place that would be better for his health. Also, they are very respectful toward him as an author. And he can teach a little bit as well. So all things considered, it looks like the best thing going. And they come to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. Buy their house from John Clellan Holmes, who wrote the seminal beat novel, Go. And they do fine. They're good there.
It's a pretty good experience.
It's a good experience.
Although he's pretty sick
yes.
at the end.
John is attached to an oxygen tank that he takes around with him. And, his students were just incredulous when they saw him do this, but he learned this trick in the Army. When he was in the Army Air Corps and he would go up in planes, they had to put on oxygen at about 15,000, 18,000 feet, something like that. But John wouldn't quit smoking. None of those guys did.
Right.
So they would put the mask over to one side of their face and breathe in out of the corner of their mouth while smoking out the
right.
other side.
Right.
And John would come to class
with
the oxygen tank and the mask.
And the cigarette.
And push the mask out of the way, take a puff, comment, exhale, and then put the mask back again.
How did John Williams die?
John died of emphysema in 1994.
So he did live
a... He did. It's surprising he lived as long as he did, poor man, you know, with his breathing problems.
Sure.
But he passed away, not angry, not regretful, knowing that his days were limited, in the company of his male friends. Nancy would invite over his buddies from the University of Denver days, and they'd all sit around, drink beer, have sandwiches, talk sports, and that's exactly the kind of camaraderie that John enjoyed. This is from the last page of the novel, when Professor Stoner is dying. He opened the book, and as he did so, it became not his own. He let his fingers riffle through the pages and felt a tingling, as if those pages were alive. The tingling came through his fingers and coursed through his flesh and bone. He was minutely aware of it, and he waited until it contained him, until the old excitement that was like terror fixed him where he lay. The sunlight passing his window shone upon the page, and he could not see what was written there. The fingers loosened, and the book they had held moved slowly and then swiftly across the still body and fell into the silence of the room.
Charles Shields, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians Frank Thurmond and Barry Burks, Nick Devlin, and Silas Height for your perfect songs. A super special thanks to composer Joseph Fuller for his perfect soundscape, with help from Fan Zhang on the cello. Thank you to actors Nathan Vandiver, Michael DeAngelis, and Frank Thurmond for lending your voices. A special thanks to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the program. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to biographer Charles Shields for so perfectly elucidating the life of novelist John Williams, who, for my money, just might well have written the perfect novel. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed these words from Stoner. I do not know what I would have done if I had not been a teacher. If I had not taught, I might have... He paused as if distracted. Then he said with finality, I want to thank you for letting me teach.